Three Mythology Podcast. Re-mythologizing our thought, words, and deeds by remembering these ancient acts of valor and wonder, that we may regenerate this present day and rekindle a hope for tomorrow.
Well, well, well. The old folks say that in a time long ago, a time before the steam train tore through the green and pleasant land, a time before wars upturned trees for the timber of ships, aye, in a time long ago, on this island is known many names: Britain, Alba, Albion, and they say that if you track to the north of these lands, up to where the mountains rise, land where my ancestors come from, and you made like a sea eagle out to the west, being met by the crashing of the ocean waves, and you saw there a great tiara of jewels, the island. North U.S., South U.S., Barra, Jura, Iona. And there, the pearl in the center of the crown, the island of Skye. And as the story goes, a long time ago, there were princes on those islands. Princes with the young sparkle of youth and adventure in their eyes, with anticipation in their breath, the young princes of the islands had gathered. Had gathered early morning. Dawn was breaking. And the prince of the island of Skye, Ian, was pushing out his father's wee boat. And 11 other princes gathered from all around the island were with him. And trailing behind was the shield bearer, a boy named Donal. Well, before the kings had risen, before the queens were out their beds, the lads had pushed that wee fishing boat, that wee curragh, into the waves, laughing as they looked on the sides of that boat, the sea demons etched and carved into the wood to keep the wildness of the sea at bay, to keep dry those who might sail it. But the lads were in no mood for superstition, laughing and joking as they went, tossing fish and spear overside, and finding their way out to the west. Well, one night had gone by. The lads had lain under the stars. The crackle of the fire amongst them. And they were starting to see things in a way they'd no seen it before. Something was cresting in that watery abyss on the edge of the known world from which they came. The next day, they pushed out, again laughing and joking on the boat. But now, moments of silence were falling between them. They were beginning to witness. They were beginning to behold the very presence, the great majesty of the world in which they wrote. And out west, to the furthest and last of the islands, they went. An island known by no man. Atlantic side, where the waves were beginning to crash. There, whinnying and huffing in the sand, with a gait of regalness, with a countenance of majesty, with eyes that spoke something of the very depths of the sea, and a coat white as the cresting of those waves was a great white horse. Well, the lads came down, pitching the boat in the sand. Ian was the first, and down he went to the horse. It seemed far greater than him, and like that he bowed something, like that he looked the horse in the eye, and like that the horse knelt down and allowed Ian onto its back. Well, next thing you knew, all 12 princes were on the back of the horse. "Come on, Donald," they cried. "Come on, lad. Come jump on the back." And they picked Donald up and they grabbed him on the rear end of that horse. And the horse started trotting. The horse started cantering. The horse started a gallop. And the lads loved it. Ecstasy wild in their eyes. Screaming, whooping, and hollering. But it was only Donald on the back who could see. It was only Donald, the young shield bearer amongst 12 princes, who noticed that the horse was no making across the land. The horse was making its way out to sea. Donald tried with all his might to jump from the back of the horse, but he was stuck fast. Some magic had come between him and his goal. So reaching down to his side, he pulled his hunting knife from his pocket, and where his hand and leg were stuck to that horse, he cut. And he jumped into the ocean waves.
And so, where are we? And where do we find ourselves? Out there in the West. The West on this island that is where the mountains start to rise up. Is where the moss starts to clad the stone and the tree, where the ferns grow under in that wet and wild and windy place. And it's the place that is open out to the vastness of the sea. And it's worth noting that for those who told it, the West was also the place of the dead. The sea was the place where the ancestors were sent, and it's the place of that otherworldly feel, where beasts rise up out of the ocean, where fairy folk come like Neve on her horse to pick up Oisin and take him to the other world, and what he has to deal with when he comes back. And so this is where our princes are headed. And whether they know it or not, something is calling them there. Something is calling them to the edges of what they know. It's the prince inside of us. It's that part of us that longs to go forward to the very boundary of where we know and break it. And see what dwells on the other side and meet it and make some kind of union or bartering or passage with it. This is, whether they've meant it or not, the kind of rite of passage that these princes have entered into. And they've been itching to do it. You can imagine how they've been knocking around in the castle. They've been watching the old men gather in halls and meet and talk quietly about how things need to be ordered and what needs to be taken care of in the fields and the farming and on the hunt. And all they long to do is find themselves in the woods with a boar and spear it. But instead, at break of dawn, before anyone's awake, they've snuck out. And it's enlivening. It's enlightening. There's a part in all of us that's cheering those boys on. Because there's a part in all of us that longs to sneak free from the boundaries of what we know and go and find that place out on the West. And that's the calling. And if you want to take this story seriously and listen more deeply to it, it's about finding that calling, perhaps, inside of yourself. Because this is what the story offers. It offers a passage. It offers keys, a code, an ancient code. And inside of it, the boys are leading us on. And it's worth noting that they go out so beautifully in this fishing boat. Just as we might drift out on the seas of our psyche to the wild places and might go fishing in there. The sea, giving that image of that vastness, the vastness of the openness, the vastness of the unknown. And when they drop their spear inside of it or they drop their fishing rod, not knowing what they might pull up. And it's a call, I think, for ecstasy. It's a call for that pure sensation, that meeting, really, with the divine. And it's not asking for a road, it's not asking for knowledge, it's just asking to see and bear witness to what they might find there and be struck by it. And there they meet it. They meet this great white horse, this symbol of the sea, who comes up just like the wave from the tumultuous underbelly of the ocean and breaks forward in this beauty, just like a wave. And there the horse is stood. And there Ian goes to meet it. And they have this moment. This moment where they look each other in the eyes and God knows what's going through his mind at that point. I doubt much. As I see it, it's that moment of pure sensation. And he's struck by it. He's alive with it. And the next thing, he's on the back of that horse and he's going. And those 11 princes are going, and all of the castle is fading behind them, and all of the bounds and the boundaries are fading behind them, all of the order is fading behind them, and they're going to the wild, wild place. The place that you don't know whether you're going to come back from. And this place can only be alive, really, if we're willing to risk something. If we're willing to let go of something. If we're willing for something to die, then we might have a chance of meeting this place. And it's the place that if it comes, it gets you quaking. Gets you quaking in your boots when you really behold the majesty of what might be there, when we drop beneath our mind, or when we go out beyond the house that holds us, beyond the home and beyond society, because this is what they've done. They've gone beyond the bounds of constriction, of anything that might bring order, and they've come to a place of pure experience. And who do they meet there but this white horse? And who is this horse? Who is this ancient beast? They know it. They know it somewhere in the telling of old tales. They know it somewhere in their bones. And they know they should run from it. Because they know somehow that if they go to meet it, they're not going to come back the same. But that's why they've got on the boat. That's why they've dared to go out, because it's an expedition of daring. And if they'd come back having never met the horse, well, as great and a jolly time as they'd have had, it wasn't really what they set out for. So what are they calling for? This is the real question. I think there's something inside of them that is eager to step forth on the road, that's eager to break out from the home, that's eager to break out from their adolescent and step into their incumbent adulthood, but they don't know how to get there. And so they've slipped in to this rite of passage. And who's come but this white horse? And so in that way, looking at them in the eyes, it's who the ocean has called forth to mature them. And that's something of the spirit of this horse. And we'll get more of that as this story goes on. But it's the one who somehow is going to make these boys grow. And I don't think it's going to be an easy road. For in that strike of pure experience, they might have thought that they'd seen it all. But the price to pay is high. This beast of the wild ocean takes them away. It takes them away even from their boat, their last vestige of protection, and takes them under the waves, through the Corivrekan and into the underworld. Because that's the price to pay for seeing this kind of knowledge. Maybe in their youth they would shine as children, maybe they would shine as adolescents, but now, stepping on a road to maturity, they're going to hit the rock bottom. They're going to see themselves really for who they are, and they're going to have to reckon with some quite hard truths. And what's so brilliant about this story is that it's not just 12 princes, but there's a 13th with them. This lowly shield bearer who has no prestige, who has no rank, who has no honour. But he is the only one who escapes. And he's calling for them to come back, to hear, to see the sense, but they are lost in wild revelry and ecstasy. And so all he can do is cut from the horse. And there's something in that image, in the image of what he's left with that weeping hand, that this beast has opened a wound. It's opened the skin. And it's saying that if you don't treat it, it's going to get worse. And so that's what the meeting does. It sets things in play. It unbalances everything. It turns the known world on its head. And this is the kind of meeting, this age-old meeting of initiation, that turns one's life upside down. And from there, from that place in the underworld, one has to go forward and find a road. And it's a hot road. And it's a hard road. And the shield bearer seems like he's going to be the one who has to walk it. And so there we leave them. 12 princes, locked in the underworld, watery ocean, and the 13th, this shield bearer, with some message, with some mission, with some road ahead of him, to bring this tale around, to regain what might be lost. And we'll find out next time how that unfolds. The Re-Mythology podcast was narrated by Duncan Sterling. A special thanks to Drew Walker for his work on the production, and to all those who helped support the funding and financing of this project.